I just basically want to outline the trajectory of justice in South Africa since the TRC, and to really just look at what of these developments mean for survivors' access to justice, as well as the development of a human rights commitment in South Africa by the government. Just quickly, you all know the South African TRC model, where amnesty was granted to those perpetrators who provided full disclosure, showed that they had a political motive. And essentially, this was something that was forced on South Africa through the negotiated settlement, where an amnesty was written into the constitutional negotiations. The process of the TRC and the way that this was formulated as part of the TRC was widely discussed, and there was broad consultation. Survivors at that point did not have an organized voice, but human rights organizations, religious organizations, etc., were very engaged in the process. And so there was a sense that different perspectives were seriously engaged. And I think without that, we would have had huge protests about the amnesty provision. So there was a certain level of acceptance that this was a pragmatic solution to a transition that had been already decided in many ways. So I think there's, just also at a political level, there was a broad consensus around it. And I think there's kind of, it was within an environment of saying, okay, this is a one-time deal. Even the Constitutional Court, when they ruled on it, they said this is acceptable in terms of South Africa's constitution. There's concerns about the indicator, they're not looking at the international legal obligations, but within the South African framework, it was kind of given their stamp of approval. The understanding of human rights organizations in South Africa, and I assume survivors at that point, was if you don't go for amnesty, if you didn't apply for amnesty, you will be prosecuted if there's evidence against you afterwards. Or if you denied amnesty, then you will be prosecuted if evidence is available. And in fact, the TRC also interpreted it that way and provided 300 cases that they had documented where people didn't apply for amnesty or refused amnesty, that they said, here's enough evidence that we think the National Prosecuting Authority should move ahead on. Those 300 cases obviously aren't the full picture. The National Prosecuting Authority hadn't collaborated very effectively with the TRC and were holding on to cases that they said, well, if we give it to the TRC, people are going to apply for amnesty and we're going to lose these cases. So let's rather hold on to them and prosecute them after the TRC. Out of those 300 plus cases, only 4 cases have been prosecuted since 2001, involving only 8 perpetrators. That is against, I don't know how many possible cases that are out there. I think on the one hand, we have to recognize that prosecutions are very difficult, and one is only ultimately looking at a small proportion of people who can be prosecuted. And so one has to cut some slack for that. But on the other hand, the government has taken various initiatives that seem to indicate that there are other motives. It's not simply about a lack of information, resources, etc. The other initiatives, as Sepo has indicated, firstly, a new prosecution policy was announced, whereby the government could, whereby the national prosecutor was given the discretion to not prosecute certain cases if people met basically the TRC criteria of disclosure of political motive. And then they throw in various other possible considerations, the attitude towards reconciliation, the degree of remorse, the sensitivity to the need for restitution, as criteria for not to prosecute someone who they have evidence available on. And the process that they suggested for this was one that was going to happen behind closed doors, that was not where the information provided by the perpetrator, the truth revealing, was not going to be made public, was not going to be shared with survivors. Survivors could make an input, but not on the basis of a response to the information that was any information given to them. Kulumani, CSVR, and the International Center for Transitional Justice, and a number of the victims' families challenged this in court, and the court ruled that this was unconstitutional. It was a rerun of the TRC's amnesty process that was explicitly a one-off deal and couldn't be revisited. That is still on appeal, so we're still hoping that it will be upheld. The second process, so that was the process for those who hadn't been prosecuted before the TRC. A second process was initiated for those who were prosecuted but didn't apply for amnesty. So people, many of them still in jail, or people prosecuted after the TRC who now are serving sentences, and basically a special presidential pardon process was announced. Initially, there was a separate pardon of 33 cases of people who were refused amnesty. Now there's a special pardon process that was instituted for those who didn't apply for amnesty. So in terms of that process, there was no rights for victims to make an input. The process was one where the president established a parliamentary committee. It's composed of representatives of political parties, where they would take applications from convicted prisoners and would review whether these people are now revealing information and whether they're politically motivated, make recommendations to the president, and the president could act on that without any soliciting any information from the victims or making any of these new revelations public again. According to that process, 121 names recommended to the president. And again, a number of organizations, including Kulumani and CSVR, challenged that process in court and managed to get an urgent interdict to prevent the president from acting on those recommendations. So that process is also, it's now halted, but it is being appealed, and there's still the court is to rule ultimately on what is the presidential discretion on matters like this. So what does this mean? And I think here, just to unpack the question of justice for survivors in South Africa, the issue, I think, has been very clearly spelled out, that survivors want justice, they want accountability, they want punishment, they want apology, they want something to be done. And in terms of what has been delivered, we've seen very little. And I just want to quickly draw a diagram. And it's very difficult to say the universe. You grab me another pen, sure. And if we're talking about a universe, no, not much better.
Oh, maybe this is a
universe of cases of, let's say, 100,000 victims of gross human rights violations, and that's a thumbs up. In that different figures have been thrown out. If you're talking about 100,000, there were 20,000 who testified at the TRC. And as we've heard, who made statements to the TRC, which is just talking to someone one-on-one in an interview. Out of those, there were only 2,000 who testified at a public hearing. And even that, we've heard, is very fairly minimal sense of satisfaction that comes from that. And the 20,000, roughly, is also people who received reparations, which were a quarter of what the TRC had recommended, and ultimately left people very frustrated. There were 1,200 amnesties, roughly 1,200 amnesties granted. So So we're looking at kind of smaller and smaller numbers. And in terms of the amnesties, that's some limited form, at least, of accountability, of being kind of a victim given the opportunity to come face to face with the perpetrator. Most of the survivors who participated in those processes were unhappy with it, weren't convinced that the perpetrator was telling the truth. Some of them had opposed the perpetrator receiving an amnesty. Another guesstimate based on a lot of work with the TRC is maybe 100 cases where there was actually an effective process of restorative justice, where a survivor and a perpetrator sit in the same room and have a serious conversation, where there's some form of one-on-one apology, possibly forgiveness, and I think the restorative justice literature, where it shows that it works in criminal justice cases, that's not the experience of South African TRC. That happened in a very small number of cases. Most of it was apologies mediated through lawyers, etc. So then we're looking at, in a small number of 121 pardons and the 33 pardons, where, and these are minute in terms of the huge population of victims we're talking about requiring justice. And I think that's where I want to kind of move on to the other issue that's more significant here. And I think this is probably fairly typical of most mass violation situations. It's also fairly typical of rape victims in South Africa, where less than 5% of them ever go to court. So it is about the difficulty of prosecuting, the difficulty of a legal system providing a sense of satisfaction ultimately. But the other side of it, and that I think that is adds insult to this injury, is the state's lack of commitment, where these issues become huge, where we as civil society blow them up, because ultimately I think what we're looking for after a period of apartheid is a commitment, an increasing commitment from the government to act to address victims' rights. Where we're looking for a process where the TRC has established some benchmark of engaging people and asking what is appropriate forms of justice, how can we deal with these difficult challenges. And now we're seeing a reverse of the prosecution policy being announced without consultation. Will they select a few individuals to consult with and claim that they've consulted? They haven't consulted Kulamani. They haven't consulted any of the human rights organizations. We have a pardons process where we had extensive attempts by a range of organizations to consult with the parliamentary reference group, to offer them that we can provide our expertise for them to contact survivors, to bring them into the process, and the doors are increasingly just closing and closing. And the consequence of that, and I think it goes beyond this issue of just human rights abuses, it is also a sense that the state wants to control the justice process. The state is interfering in the justice process. And I think the prosecutorial discretion, rather than the way the judges act, it's a question of what cases reach the judges, and after the judge made a decision, what happens with the sentencing. That the state can narrow the scope where judges have an impact on justice in South Africa, where what reaches the judges is faulted, and the impact of a judgment is eroded. And I think that goes to the core, deeper issues of democracy. It's not just about individual victims' rights, which are balanced here against perpetrator rights, but it's about the credibility of a legal system where people can have faith that a legal system can protect them, that a legal system will act against perpetrators. And I think here it's not just certain, it's about people, perpetrators, connection to political linkages, And in South Africa, it goes across the board. The people on the list of pardons, the 121 people recommended for pardons, it's the right wing, the RVBO, who attacked indiscriminate black targets, a taxi rank, where people were blown out. It's ANC people involved in kind of local war with the IFP. It's PAC members. And it's around the issue that political parties are seen as protecting their perpetrators while dismissing the needs of victims. And it's about those values that we felt the TRC is supposedly entrenching, is setting certain benchmarks, is setting certain precedents that we felt kind of that gives us a basis to build on. It's not, and now it's achievements that are being eroded that we're just trying to keep that that shift at bay. So I think it's, and it really does come to the issues that Sepo mentioned, issues of empowering the victims to speak out about these issues, because it also, it's, I think, like with the pardons issue, it's something I'm passionate about, but it's not something I am able to challenge the government on. It's you can discredit human rights organizations so easily, the funding issue, our dependence on funding, but if you have 60,000 survivors talk out about these issues, you shift the political balance. And I think that's where we're still struggling to find out, and I think it's to develop a coalition politics where human rights organizations and survivors can play complementary roles to do this effectively.
Thank you.